Very good evening, brothers and sisters in the Dharma. It is our great honor to have invited Ajahn Brahmavamsa, or formerly known as Ajahn Brahm, to conduct a 10-day retreat in the Mahindrama Buddhist Temple. And tonight is the second last day of the retreat. And for those of you who are still not too familiar with Ajahn Brahm, please allow me to give a brief introduction about Ajahn. Ajahn Brahm was born in London in 1951. Ajahn regarded himself a Buddhist at the age of 17 through his reading of Buddhist books while still at school. Ajahn's interest in Buddhism and meditation flourished while studying theoretical physics at Cambridge University. After completing his degree and teaching for a year, Ajahn travelled to Thailand to become a monk. Ajahn was ordained in Bangkok at the age of 23 by the abbot of Wat Sakee, and subsequently spent 9 years studying and training in the forest meditation tradition of the Venerable Ajahn Chah. In 1983, Ajahn was asked to assist in the establishing of a monastery near Perth, Western Australia. Ajahn Brahm is now the abbot of Bodhiyana Monastery and the spiritual director of the Bodhi Society of Western Australia. Ajahn is also the spiritual patron of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. Brothers and sisters in the Dharma, tonight we have another interesting topic which will be enlightened by Ajahn. Tonight's topic will be on Buddhist economics and the credit squeeze.
Thank you. I don't know, have you ever heard any other monk talk about economics and the credit squeeze? Especially a monk like myself, who should have a lot of experience in such fields. Because I'm a monk who's got no bank account, no investments, no shares, not even any cash. I'm totally penniless. I haven't had any money for over 35 years. So I know everything about economics. In fact, it's sometimes amazing that as a monk you can give a talk about anything. And I've done this so often now. On one occasion, I was part of my community service in Western Australia. I was invited to a seminar run by the Australian government on transport, because they wanted people from different parts of their society to give them some input on how to improve the conveyance of people and goods, especially in Western Australia. It was a transport seminar. And at lunchtime, everybody else, all the delegates, went off for lunch, but it was after 12 o'clock, so I couldn't eat anything. So I was just hanging around there, and this man came up to me and said, "Aren't you going for lunch?" I said, "No, I'm a monk, I've already eaten today." And he said, "Oh, would you mind if I interview you?" Because he was a journalist, and he was writing for shipping magazines. "So can I interview about shipping matters?" And of course, I know absolutely nothing about shipping. But nevertheless, he gave an interview and I gave answers. And about 3 months later, I met that gentleman again on some other sort of meeting. And he told me that that interview was syndicated in all the major shipping magazines of the world. He gave it the title Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm. And he said he got all these emails back from his colleagues saying, "I've never heard of that Ajahn Brahm before, but he certainly knows what he's talking about." And so even though it's shipping, something I have no experience on, or even another occasion, which I like telling people about because it was very funny, one of my disciples in Perth, he was one of the managers or producers in a radio broadcasting company. And he said that every now and again they have talkback shows on the radio. And he says he's come to listen to my talks and see me answer questions. He said, "You're much better than some of these other JoJos who go on radio. Why don't you come back on my show on talkback radio?" And of course, I'm always open for anything. So I said, "Yeah, okay, but you know, I'm so busy, it's very hard to find the time." And I said, "But every weekend I'm in town. This is how we run our organization in Perth. On Friday night, Saturday and Sunday, I'm in our city temple, which is very convenient for people. And on Sunday evening, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday morning, I'm at the monastery, which is about 60 kilometers outside of Perth. So I said, if you want me to go on a radio show, have it on the weekend sometime. So he said, how about Friday night? And I said, I'd give a talk late on Friday night. He said, fine. So we arranged to go on this talk show from 10 p.m. till 12 p.m. midnight on a Friday night. So, after finishing the ordinary Friday night talk, like giving a talk here, as soon as you finish, you get in the car and go to the radio studios. And you know, just like here, people were coming up, asking me questions, signing books, you know, as normal, and so I was very late. So I had to rush to the radio studios, and I got there just on time. It was straight into the studio, put the headphones on in front of the microphone, before, you know, you could find out, you know, what the show was all about. And as they gave the introductions, you know, on air, they say, and tonight we're very fortunate to have a Buddhist monk. And it was too much for the announcer to get my name right, Ajahn Brahm. So I said, just call me Mr. Monk. So tonight we have Mr. Monk, and also we have Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, and who has written many, many books and is the expert in Australia on sexual matters. And at that, I thought, oh my goodness, what type of show is this? And the announcer told everybody, and welcome to Friday Night Adult Themes Talkback. And there I was. It was too late to run out of the studio. And for the next 2 hours, we were taking questions from the general public about adult themes. And I've been celibate for about 30 odd years. So what would I know about the problems between husbands and wives? Actually, lots. Because when I gave the first few answers, and this is no exaggeration, everybody was ringing in. And do you want to speak to Mr. Monk or Dr. Morrissey? Mr. Monk, please. It was true. I was doing all the work. And the expert in the whole of Australia, she was sitting next to me, twiddling her thumbs, getting bored, because no one was interested in her answers. They were all interested in Mr. Monk's answers. And that also showed me that when you understand Buddhism, now real Buddhism, the way the mind works, the way the world works, you can actually understand anything from shipping to adult matters to economics. So that is why I have the authority to speak on economics and the credit squeeze this evening. Probably even more authority than some professor of economics at the university. Because look, what do those professors of economics know? Did any of them predict the credit crunch? None of them did. They should all get the sack for incompetence. If they don't know what's going on and show what's going to happen, so what is their use? It's like having a weather forecaster who can't predict rain or a storm. So, I have full authority. Actually, to show you just how it works, I remember one of those questions on that radio show. And I was very proud of this answer, because when you're a monk, you can be very relaxed, very clear, and you can actually understand what people are really asking. Whereas professors, all they know is the theory. Monks know the mind. So this man called up. He was a taxi driver in Perth, because the late night shows, the taxi drivers, when they're waiting for a passenger for a fare, they listen to the radio, and sometimes, nothing else to do, they ask questions. So this taxi driver rang up, can I speak to Mr. Monk? Yeah, here he is. Yes, how can I help you? And this is what he said. I'll always remember this. He said, Mr. Monk, I'm having an affair with a woman. My wife doesn't know about it. Is this all right? That's what he asked me on air. Everyone listening. I'm having an affair with another woman, not my wife. My wife doesn't know about it. Is this okay? Now, what would you answer? My answer came out automatically. I said, "Sir, if it was all right, you would not be ringing me up to ask." And he hung up straight away. I nailed him, as they say. I knew exactly what he was doing. Because as a man, he knew it was wrong. If he thought it was right, he wouldn't be asking anybody. He'd just go ahead and do it. He knew it was wrong. He wanted some expert to tell him it was okay to get rid of his guilt. He felt guilty about it, as you would. And so straight away, I wasn't going to answer good or bad. I said, "You know it's bad. That's why you're ringing me up, to try and get me to say it's good, aren't you?" And that's why he hung up straight away, because, you know, I had him. So when you're a monk, especially a meditating monk, you can be really sharp. You can see deeper than other people, which is why you can go on these shows about something you haven't done for over 30 years and know exactly how to answer these questions, whether it's shipping, sex, or tonight, economics. So, economics and the credit crunch, or the Buddhist attitude to economics. Now, what is that Buddhist attitude to economics? Actually, I remember one experience I had. There's one of my friends. He's the chairman of the committee who looks after our monasteries in UK. He's a very good friend. I often see him at conferences because he's a lecturer, a professor of economics in Reading University, an advisor to the Bank of England. So he's a very, very experienced economist. And he's also a very, very devoted Buddhist, Professor Colin Ash. And he came to one conference and he was going to present a paper, but then he changed it at the last minute to make it more interesting. And the paper he gave was "The Economic Benefit of Monks and Nuns." Now, what economic benefit are we? What do we actually produce for the economy? Or are we just leeches which just suck your money through ang paos, which take away the food from your table? What do we actually produce? He was asking. And these are good questions. So what's the economic value of Sangha? And he introduced me to a concept which will be central probably to the first part of this talk anyway, to something in business or economics they call transaction costs. Because he said in business, he said, whenever you are purchasing a product, number one, you cannot trust that the product described by the vendor, the person selling it, is exactly what they say it is. You know, whether it's medicines or whether it's a car, the people selling this vehicle to you always exaggerate, you know, how fast it can go. They always exaggerate how comfortable it is. They always exaggerate just how cheap it is. Because that's how we sell things. So if you buy something, you always have to take into consideration that what they tell you it's going to do is probably not what it does do. Which means that you have to factor in that that product you're buying is not going to be exactly what you want. Number two, they may tell you, "We'll deliver it in a week." 1 month later, it still hasn't come. So sometimes they even exaggerate on the delivery time. And you have to factor that, you know, into your business. And of course, that's just purchasing things. And when you sell things to someone, and they say, "Yes, you know, send us the invoice and we'll pay straight away." And sometimes the invoice stays week after week and they still don't pay you. And that also has to be factored in. The fact that the person who buys the goods does not give you the money straight away. And he said, because they're obviously in business, the people selling, you know, want to get them exaggerate what they're giving you, so they can get more money, And the person buying wants to give the less money and keep the money as long as they possibly could before they give it to you. And he said, in a course terms, that's called transaction costs. And it's all because of greed and dishonesty. And he was saying, one of the great benefits of monks in a community is that we encourage everybody to be honest and to be trustworthy. Because if you're honest and trustworthy, it means that the product which I'm selling, what I say it is, it actually is. You don't exaggerate. And if I tell you it's going to come on time, I make sure it does come on time. That's why it's very easy for Chiao Po to deal with me. When I say I'm coming at a certain time to Penang Airport, I will arrive that time. If the plane is delayed, I'll let him know. But when I say I'm going to give a talk every night and give interviews, that's what I do. What I say I will do, I always produce the goods, which is why he can trust me. The same way that I can trust him. All those ang paos and donations which you put in there, you know, Chiao Po will send it to me later on, as soon as he possibly can. So we trust each other. That's why it's very easy to do business with you, Chiao Po. That means that when there's monks who encourage honesty and trustworthiness, it means when you're purchasing something, you know what it says it will do, it will do. And the person buying it from you, because they're trustworthy, they'll pay you straight away. Which means that reduces what this economist called transaction costs. And transaction costs have a huge weight on economic performance. Basically because people don't trust each other. And if there's anyone does business here, I think you know what I'm talking about. It's much better to do business with people we trust, who are honest, straightforward, because that will save us a lot of time and a lot of loss in our profits. Trust works. And I've known this from my own experience. I remember once when we were building our monastery in Australia. Now, I already mentioned in an earlier talk, I was a builder. Now, I did the concrete work, the brick work, the roofing, the carpentry, the plumbing, everything. So when you were doing the carpentry, I had to go to the woodyard and buy the timber. So I went with one of the attendants, I ordered the timber, he paid for it, you know, with a check. That's how we work these things. So sometimes, if you've ever been shopping, this was in a timber yard, there was so much timber, we put it on a trolley and we paid for it all. But when I got back to monastery and I checked all the timber, oh my goodness, there was a few pieces of wood which I'd missed, we hadn't paid for. Now this was totally honest, it was just an honest mistake, there was so much there, it was only double checking, I realized it wasn't on the invoice, we hadn't paid for it. So I'm a monk, what do? The next day go back to the timber yard and say, look, yesterday we got two or three planks of wood we didn't pay for, here's the check. And this Australian man who was serving, he looked at me, he said, what? I said, look, remember yesterday we came here? I remember you. I don't know how he keeps remembering me. But he remembered me, and he said, if this was an Australian man, a builder, if they got away without paying for three pieces of timber, they would never come back. And he said, I'm so struck by your honesty. And so he disappeared for a little while. He went to see the manager. And then the manager and him agreed from that time on to give our monastery 10% discount, which was always only for real builders, professional builders. And so the amount of money we paid for that extra wood, which we basically didn't need to because they didn't realize it was missing, because of our honesty, maybe that we have to pay about $20 for that extra wood, we made hundreds thousands of dollars over those years because of the 10% discount. And afterwards I realized why they gave us that discount is because these monks, you can trust them. So they're going to save us money. We don't have to check it so much. And in some of those hardware stores where we go to get our stuff for our monastery, the head of the hardware store says, oh, just go in the back, get what you want. And we just go and choose it ourselves. Other people aren't allowed in the back, but we are. And then, what have you got? They don't even check. We write it down because we are honest. Now, because we are so honest, it cuts down their transaction costs. They don't have to send a person with us to get the stuff and make sure we're not taking too much and putting it into our bags. And they don't have to look at all the items we've got and count them out. Say, what have you got? They believe us straight away. That saves a lot of time and money for them. So this is an example of what we mean by transaction costs. And how, when people are honest, it's a win-win on either side. So as Buddhist economics, one of the first things we try and encourage is real honesty in business. Sure, it means that sometimes you don't get quick profits, but you know people who get quick profits because they cheat, now they usually lose their suppliers, lose their clients when people find out, you know, just how much they're cheating. But if you want to have a company or a business or an economy in your country which is going to be sustainable, have sustainable growth, trust is one of the most important commodities to develop, and that means your honesty. So your supplier, your customer trusts you, and this is where Buddhism and many other religions can really encourage things like precepts and honesty as a basis for a strong economy. It just cuts a lot of red tape, a lot of needless extra hours of work, just trying to make sure you're not being cheated, trying to make sure the other person's going to pay on time. Transaction costs. So with that degree of honesty, now in Buddhist economics, you will find that the economic performance of any country, of any business, will increase. But it's not just honesty which is useful in Buddhist economics. Surprise, surprise, compassion and kindness is also a commodity which we can put in our businesses, which actually increases our profits and the quality of life in your company. This is Buddhist economics by putting compassion in. And many CEOs think, well, how can you be compassionate? Business is cutthroat. It's a dog-eat-dog world. If you are kind, you are going to lose out. Kind people finish second, they say. But in real life, a little bit of compassion creates that trust, creates that networking, which is so important. Not just in business, in your company, and in your life. And the example of this, which I remember teaching, one of the other things which I did, which shows you just how wide you spread these teachings on Buddhism. A few years ago, I was invited, all expenses paid, to go to London, all the way from Australia, to give a masterclass at the biggest human resources conference in Europe, at the HR conference, in this amazing conference centre called Excel in Docklands in London. And they invited me all the way over there to teach the CEOs of PricewaterhouseCoopers, British Airways, and a few other companies, I can't remember who they were now, to teach them how to run their business. And I'm a Buddhist monk. And whatever I said there must have gone down very well, because as soon as I returned to Australia, there was an email waiting for me from the British National Health Service, who were inviting me to fly back, not to London this time, to Birmingham, to give a keynote at their annual general meeting of the British National Health Service. However, I had to decline because it was only in a couple of weeks' time and I hadn't overcome my jet lag yet. And I told them, I wrote back to them and said, look, you're the British National Health Service. If I travel all the way to London again, that will be bad for my health. And you'll be hypocrites making me come. So I had to take a break. You know, everyone is human, so I had to take a break. So I never went to that one. But certainly, obviously, what I said really made a lot of impact for these CEOs, and one of them was from the National Health Service, about Buddhist economics in the sense of looking after the personnel, which make the economy turn over profitably. Because you cannot divorce the economic performance of a country or a company from the people who contribute their sweat and their labor and their wisdom to make that company and those profits actually happen. And I told them of a story which I'd read. People actually tell me these interesting stories of businesses or scientists or from wherever, which is really a very Buddhist attitude, and how well it works. So this disciple sent me a cutting from an engineering journal about an engineering company, again in the UK, which had won a prize for the best economic performance that particular year. And the article was describing this company, and I still remember its name, it was about 2 or 3 years ago, Farrelly and Sons, which did building maintenance throughout the UK. And this company, a big company, in 12 months had trebled their turnover and doubled their profits. Now that was not the main reason they won this prestigious prize for economic performance. Yes, they trebled turnover and doubled their profits, but it was the innovative way they achieved this, which impressed everybody and gave them the prize. And I shared this with some of the people in the HR conference. Their strategy was very simple and very compassionate and wise. The company banned all overtime. That's all they did. They said, you have so many hours to work, when you finish those hours, you go home, and you don't take work back home with you. Now, for many people, that would be counterintuitive. If you don't get the maximum work out of your employees, if sometimes they don't have the opportunity to take their work home, to finish off the contract in time, your company is going to go under. You really have to compete. And compete sometimes means working longer hours. But this company proved otherwise. Because they were wiser. They looked more deeply into what happens at work. And as I've mentioned here in an earlier talk, it's not the amount of hours you spend at work. It's the efficiency of your work. It's the performance level. And sometimes if we measure performance just by how many hours you sit at the desk, that's not an accurate measure. Your output, how much you get done, and the quality of that output, that's what the measure of success is. So this company realized that if they exploited their workers and make them work too long hours, number one, at the end of the day, they get so stressed, so tired, the quality of their work goes down. And when they go home, they're stressed, and they have arguments with their family, they have family problems. And when they go to work the following morning, they haven't rested well, and they take those family problems to work with them. they can't work to their highest capacity. Because these two reinforce each other, your family life and your work life. If you have a happy work life, you'll have a happy family life. A happy family life, a happy work life. And if one is suffering, so does the other. The company saw this and realized you do need time to rest, to be with your family. If you haven't got that time, you will have problems with your kids, with your wife, with your husband, with your family, with your health. Which means you cannot perform well at work. So, now's the end of the day, go home, spend time with your family. When you go to get to work the following morning, you're fresh, happy, your efficiency goes up. Sure, you don't work as many hours, but you get more done. And the quality of your work is higher. And if you have to deal with people, either clients, suppliers, or people in your office, if you are stressed out, you get grumpy, you get angry, and you all know what that means in your workplace, in your office. Office politics, backstabbing, people being unkind to you, people not helping you, people spreading bad gossip about you. Is that good for the economy? Is that going to increase the amount of work which gets done in your company? It is wasting precious time. So when people are in a good mood, you don't waste so much time. You get more done, higher quality. So by giving people that simple thing, saying, you go home at a certain time, straight away they are taking out a lot of stress, which was the cause of bad performance in the office, in the company. And the suppliers, their clients, you were just kinder to them. And if you're much kinder, especially to your customers, you get more customers, and the customers stick with you. You know that personal relationships in business count for much more than people give credit for. You like doing business with people who are kind to you, or people who are happy. That's why you come and do business with me, because I'm happy. If I was a grumpy monk, not many people would come. You are my clients. And I'm selling you the Dhamma. And you keep coming, because I treat you well and I'm happy. Now that's the same with your business. You get more clients, and even your suppliers are more willing to help you out if you are kind to them. This is human nature. So this company realized that, and it was a happier company. And actually another thing happened. Because the company was showing some care to their employees, by cutting overtime, or say banning overtime, the company said, look, we care about you when you go home. We want you to have rest. We want you to have a happy family life. Not many companies did that. So the people working for that company thought, these bosses are actually kind people. They care about us and they're wise. And so the staff turnover fell to zero. No one wanted to leave. Even if they were offered better jobs with more money, who wants to leave when you're having such a happy, productive time? And in fact, at that conference I talked to another HR manager. It was a HR manager of the Department of Fisheries and Transport of something else in the British government. And she was telling me, said, look, in my experience, people will not move to another company for a higher salary if that company is looking after them and caring for them. The salary is only one part of the reason why people want to move. It's also what people call job satisfaction. If you're really happy at a company and you're really feeling you're doing good work and making a difference, and another company offers you more money, I don't want to go. The extra salary is not usually the main incentive. It's an interesting job, a challenge or something. That's what makes people move. But when people do move from a company, that company loses a lot. You have to hire a new person, train them up, and all the time you're training them up, when they're getting to know their job, knowing the customers, knowing the suppliers, and knowing the other people they have to work with, their productivity is very, very low. It takes a while to crank them up, and I'm talking about 6 months, 8 months sometimes to learn the job. And the company is losing all that time. It makes sense to try and retain your staff. They've already been trained, they know the job. If you let them go to another job, you have to spend so much work time, which could be used in other productive areas, training them up again. So he said, the losing staff is a big drain on the economy. But this particular company, because of compassion, they kept the staff. Compassion, good old Buddhist religious compassion, is a great asset in the economy. It keeps people there working instead of thinking they want to go to another job. So staff turnover went down, and that was one of the other reasons why turnover trebled and profit doubled. And so that simple strategy of banning overtime, it had these huge knock-on effects of the efficiency in that particular company. And that could be transferred to many, many other parts of an economy in Malaysia or any other country. And I've been trying to push this for a long time when I give talks to corporates, saying, remember, it's the efficiency of your personnel, not the amount of time they work. And part of that efficiency is when they do get stressed out, give them time to relax. I told that story a couple of days ago. How heavy is the cup? The longer you hold it, the heavier it gets. If you keep holding this for too long, you stress out. If you keep your face in front of that computer screen for too long, your brain gets stuffed up. You just can't work efficiently. So that you will know when you've been working too long, that is the time to stop and take time out. You all know Dell Computing, one of the top companies now in the world. In the headquarters of Dell, there is a time-out room. That room is screened so you can get no messages on your mobile, no SMSs, nothing on your BlackBerry. And anybody, from the CEO to the cleaning ladies, is allowed to enter that time-out room or group of rooms at any time, whenever they want. It's not taken off from the amount of time you work. That's part of your opportunity when you're working, because the company realizes that when any of their workers is stressed out, they can't perform, their efficiency falls, and they can, especially in the higher echelons of management or research, they can make mistakes which prove catastrophic to the company. You just can't afford to make such mistakes. So looking after the people in the company by giving them a time-out room when you get stressed, go out there. If you're Buddhist, you can meditate. You can just have a cup of coffee and just watch the fish in the aquarium, whatever you do, just so that you can relax and take time out. And then afterwards, when you go back to your work, you are efficient. You've rested. Now, I realized that about the efficiency of using your brain very early on in my Buddhist career. This is the story of how I did well in my final examinations at Cambridge. And this was 1972, where I did the final examinations in theoretical physics. Now, things have changed a lot in 40 years, or less, 37 years. In those days, final examinations were final exams. Everything depended on those examinations. Everything else you'd done before counted for absolutely nothing. For theoretical physics, 6 days of exams, starting on a Monday. 3 hour paper in the morning, 1 hour for lunch, and a 3 hour paper in the afternoon. Same on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, same on Thursday, and Friday, and Saturday as well. 6 days in a row, 3 hours in the morning, 1 hour for lunch, 3 hours in the afternoon. That was very stressful. If Amnesty International had have known, they'd have called that torture. And of course, this was important. Now, this was university exams. Everyone was saying, if I did well, you're made. Imagine getting a good degree from Cambridge. If only I had known I was going to become a monk, I wouldn't have needed to worry so much. I could have just, who cares? But I never knew I was going to become a monk, so I had to work harder and perform. But I had an advantage over everybody else. I was already a Buddhist, and I already learned how to meditate. And my goodness, that was powerful. Because what I did, I didn't develop any psychic powers. What are the questions going to be? Yes. Now that would have been cheating. But what I did do was I never had any lunch any of those days. I went back to my room instead of having lunch, sat on my cushion and meditated. Now this is what happened. It's a good description of what meditation is in real life. As soon as I sat down and closed my eyes and made myself comfortable, I couldn't think of the breath or any other meditation object. The first thing which came into my mind, the morning examination. What have I done? Did I answer the question properly? Should have I added some more explanation? What had I done? Now we all know that once that examination is finished, right or wrong, you can't change it. The past is set in stone. So let it go. But how many of you can do that? It's only because I trained myself over a few years that I could actually let go of the morning exam. I didn't worry about it. Good or bad, finished, I'm not even going to think about it. So I could let go of the past, even though it was important. So having let go of the morning examination, the next thing which came into my mind was the afternoon exam. Should I get some books out? Should I get off the cushion and start revising? But there's one thing I had noticed, that everything you look up half an hour before an examination never ever comes up in the paper. It's a complete waste of time. However, many of you can't resist, just in case, getting out the books. As for me, I had trained myself. I knew that the best way to prepare for the afternoon examination was to rest in the present moment. Now was the time my future was being made. So instead of looking into the books, I just let go of the future and I could rest. The next thing which came into my mind shocked me at the time, because when I wasn't worrying about the past exam or thinking about the future exam, when I actually did come into the present moment, I noticed my body was shaking. It was nervousness. Now, I'm not usually a nervous person, but this was a high stress time, final examinations. It was understandable that anyone would be nervous. But what shocked me, I hadn't noticed I was shaking, because I wasn't paying attention. Once I noticed that, I could just relax and relax and relax until all the nervousness and shaking disappeared. Nervousness really lowers your performance. You can never perform up to your potential. I'll tell another little story about that. I'm going off on a tangent here. This is a story of the lady who won the gold medal in the 2000 Sydney Olympics in the 800 meter sprint. This is a great story. In Sydney in 2000 at the Olympic Games, the New South Wales government, this is the state in which Sydney resides, was organising the Olympic Games, the 2000 Olympic Games. And in the Olympic Village, which was in a place called Homebush Bay, the government invited religious leaders to stay in that village throughout the games to give religious counselling, prayers or whatever to any athlete which needed it. Because religion is a great support, and this was very stressful, running in the Olympics. And so, because Buddhism was a major religion, there was one of the monks who lived in Sydney was invited to live in the Olympic Village throughout the Olympic Games to offer any religious service to any Buddhist who was performing. And this particular story appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald. He said that on one day, three people came to see him: mother, father, and the girl who was the athlete. They were from Russia. The family told him, the mother and father told him, that their daughter had exceeded all expectations and got into the final of the Olympic Games 800 meter sprint. This was one of the central events. In a couple of days' time, their daughter would be running in front of the TV cameras of the world. Not just performing in front of her friends and relations back in her town in Russia, but in front of everybody. And she was so nervous that she couldn't sleep at night, let alone train. She was a nervous wreck. And the family said, "We're not Buddhists, but we know Buddhists are the experts in meditation, which relaxes you. Please, monk, can you teach our daughter how to meditate? At least she can rest at night, so she doesn't make a fool of herself in a couple of days' time in the final." So the monk taught this girl how to meditate, just simple meditation. And then they went away, "Thank you very much." However, monks don't watch TVs, so he didn't know what happened until about 3 days later he saw the family walking towards him, the mother, father, and the athlete in the middle. And as they came closer, the next thing he noticed, they were smiling. Oh, something must have done well. And the next thing they noticed, the little girl, the girl in the middle, the athlete, was what he said was swinging something on a string. He didn't know what medals were. He thought it was just something on a string that was swinging. And it was only when they came really close he noticed it was the colour gold. And the family had come up to say thank you to the monk for teaching their daughter how to relax, let go of her nervousness, and win a medal no one ever expected she would win. She exceeded her potential and won an Olympic gold medal because a monk taught her how to meditate. How did Malaysia do in the Asian Games? Or was it the Southeast Asian Games, wasn't it? I saw something in the newspaper. How did they do? Very well. I know Thailand came top because I was in Thailand at the time, it was in the newspapers. I think it was in Laos, wasn't it? Thailand came top. Laos, yeah. Where did Malaysia come? Fourth. Why didn't they come top? Because you didn't get a monk teaching them how to meditate. You've got lots of monks in this country. Next time, get a monk to teach them to meditate. Not only will they relax, but those two people, the one who does high jump, teach them how to levitate. They just sit there cross-legged, they go way out. No, but the meditation teaches you how to relax. This athlete was relaxed, and that's what I did. When I finished off the shaking, I realized my brain was so tired. Because I'd been working 3 hours doing a theoretical physics exam. That's a lot of brain power you use up. But when I relaxed, all the brain power came back again. After half an hour meditation, I was like waking up in the morning, the first time of the day, relaxed, fresh, ready to go. Like that Russian athlete would have been when she started her race. Which is why in the afternoon I did really well in those examinations. Why in Dell Computing, people rest and relax like that, and then they can perform to a really high level. Otherwise, you're just getting by. The work you do, yeah, it gets by, but it's not high quality and it's not efficient. Which is why if you want to increase the economic performance of any company or business, having time out rooms where people can just relax and learn a bit of meditation, you will improve your performance immensely. And the performance of a company improving means the performance of your economy improves. Which means that you can compete in these difficult economic times. But I'm running out of time because sometimes we call about the credit crunch or the credit squeeze. And we all know, I don't know why people keep forgetting, basic Buddhist teachings of impermanence. That yes, stock markets go up and stock markets go down again. Now rise and fall, impermanence. But if you can keep your head and don't panic, you can sit out any recession when you prepare for it. You prepare for the credit crunches, the squeezes, the recessions, which always have to come. They always have come in the past, they will come in the future. It's just rise and fall. To understand what I mean, there's a story in my book which is very pertinent. And it's a story of the emperor's ring. Now I'm going to change it in this story because I don't always want to change the same story. I'm going to call this the story of the president's ring. Once upon a time, there was a president of the United States. And every time the economy was going well, he was winning his wars, and there was no terrorism, he would spend all of them, not all the money, he would have a lot of parties and celebrations. And in fact, he was spending so much time partying and celebrating that he wasn't really working hard for his country. So the good economic times never lasted very long. And soon the country fell into recession. And as soon as it fell into recession, the president was so gloomy, so upset, so depressed. He spent a lot of his time arguing with other people, even spending a lot of time in his room, sulking and getting depressed. And so his advisors thought, how can we teach the president how to be a better president? And all they did was they got someone to make a ring for him, a gold ring. And they presented it to the president and told him to wear it on all occasions. It was a very simple ring, except for the words inscribed on the outside. And the words on the outscribed read, "This too will pass." And he had to wear that ring and keep looking at it. So, whenever the economy was going well, he'd look at the ring. This too will pass. He knew that economic stability and growth was impermanent, fragile. And because of that, he never took the strength of an economy for granted. He worked his butt off trying to make the economy even stronger, putting stuff aside for when the economy did go down, because he knew it would. And because he never took the economic growth, prosperity for granted, the prosperous times lasted longer than normal. And when eventually it turned into a recession or a slump, he never lost his hope. He never panicked. Because he knew this too will pass. Even recessions pass. Depressions pass. They have to. This too will pass. So he never lost his hope. He never lost his vision. He kept on working as hard as ever without getting upset and blaming other people. Which is why the bad times never lasted as long. Now, if any of you are in any positions of authority or power, running a company or being a departmental manager or just being a boss of a monastery like me, I remember that ring. I'm not allowed to wear rings, but I have it engraved on my heart. This too will pass. So I know that if you have any difficulties and troubles, it will pass. You still work hard. You never get depressed. And when things are going well in your organization, in Mahindarama Party School, things are going well, the retreat is going well, it doesn't mean you can sit back and take it for granted, because it passes. All happiness and prosperity is fragile, anicca, impermanent, as the Buddha kept on saying. So in times of prosperity, you still have to work hard to keep that prosperity lasting as long as possible. And when it does slump, you expected it. So you prepared for it. And that way, you'll find the prosperous times last longer and the recessive times don't last as long. How many people get really depressed when it gets difficult? How many people get surprised when it gets difficult? You know this is going to happen. I've been alive long enough, and even as a monk you've noticed so many recessions, so many booms. And even though what any economists say, no, we've now fireproofed the economy, there will not be any recessions anymore, we've sorted out the banking system, we've got all the regulations in place, there will never be any credit crunch again. Yeah. Of course there will. It'll go up, go down, up, go down, up, go down. But the person who is wise, who can ride out such economic ups and downs, is the people who prepare for it. And know this too will pass. I know that I was in Singapore and people said, oh my goodness, it's a recession, a credit squeeze, this is the end of the world, the banking system is broken, the Western system of capitalism is at its end, we're all going to go down, 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 down. Now, I remember hearing that. People are crazy. Yeah, it goes down, then it goes up, then it goes down again, then it goes up again. You know that is our world. So don't overreact. Whenever there's any economic problems, boom and bust, when people overreact, that's a problem. And one thing which Buddhism can teach you is how to keep cool. Yeah, it's going up, that's okay. Yeah, it's going down, yeah, that's okay. Just like the monks, the ill and sick, yeah, that's okay. They're fit and healthy, that's okay. And sometimes we're so equanimous, you don't know when we're about to die. You're sitting up here giving a talk and then you're off. That's wonderful when it's like that. So you're never upset. People criticize you, people praise you, you're always equanimous. Now that's what we need in economic managers.
people who don't overreact. Say, it will pass, don't worry about it, it's all going to be okay, as it always is.
So, this evening I've said a lot about Buddhist economy and the credit squeeze, how to increase the performance of the businesses and companies in Malaysia, especially in Penang. You know, the Australian economy was one of the few Western economies, developed economies, which didn't go into recession. And you know, the powerhouse behind the Australian economy is Western Australia, where I live. Perhaps you know why now. Okay, thank you for listening. So, any questions about the economy, first of all, before I go off into questions about who knows what? Okay, questions about who knows what. Here we go. First of all, from yesterday. Again, questions about anything will do. Kindly elaborate further. One will never fall into the woeful state if one has faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, coupled with loving kindness, as stated in the sutta. But why Buddhists seem to stress little on loving kindness, most look sulky. Christians seem to do better. They look cheerful. Do they do plastic surgery? No. Some. Actually, I don't know about you, but the Buddhists I know are usually very happy and very happy people, which is actually why that sometimes people say, who's the happiest people on earth? You know, who's happier? The Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, or the Dalai Lama? Ask people who are not Buddhists, they say the Dalai Lama is much happier than the Pope or the Archbishop of Canterbury. Ask science. Professor Davidson of the University of Wisconsin famously did these experiments to find out the happiest people in the world. And you don't have to be subjective about this. You can do scans of the brain. There's a part of the brain which lights up when you're happy. So Professor Davidson had a means of actually finding, not if a person says they're happy or if they're smiling, but they're feeling miserable inside. Oh, I'm really having a very bad day, but I'm going to smile anyway. No, it was really happy, because they could see how much this part of the brain lights up. And Professor Davidson experimented with heaps of people until he came across Buddhist monks. And when he scanned their brains, you read his book, their happiness went way off the scale. They weren't just a little bit ahead of other people. They were way ahead of other people in happiness. And this was measured on a PET scan. So it's actually scientifically proven that Buddhists are happier than everybody else. Objective science. Now, people may say, well, my religion is the happiest religion, because that's just self-promotion. But really, the Buddhists are the happiest, especially the ones who come to Ajahn Brahm's talks. So, meditation. How can a beginner get focused quickly to look inwards? How can they get focused quickly? Start by being patient. The very question, you want to do it quickly. That's why you can't. Once when I was, a couple of years ago, I was in Sri Lanka giving a series of talks. One of those talks was in the town of Kandy, which is maybe, it's only about 100 kilometers from Colombo, but the roads are very bad. It takes about 4 or 5 hours. So my driver taking me back from Kandy to Colombo, halfway on the journey, decided to take a shortcut. And the 4-hour journey turned into an 8-hour journey when he got lost. So much for shortcuts. So when everyone asks me, how can a beginner get focused quickly? How can one have shortcuts? The fastest way is the patient way. So if you want to do it quickly, you just come to the next retreat in Mahindarama Temple. And try not to get any shortcuts, but do it the slow, patient, efficient way. If you try and take shortcuts, it will take forever. Not quickly, but do it slowly. It's really important for you to learn how to make peace. Peace of mind is the most valuable thing in the world. So it's worthwhile spending the time creating that peace. When I practice meditation, I feel like I'm cultivating my mind in a separate way, path. Regardless of what arising, I just continue to make peace, letting go and not paying attention to all kinds of formations. I feel like I'm traveling on a path that has nothing to do about myself. Kindly advise whether I'm practicing correctly. Yes! You're getting rid of yourself. Letting go of the ego, letting go of me, not mine, not a self. Going into the grey emptiness. That's why sometimes people in Australia, they ask me, Ajahn Brahm, what should we call you? What is the correct term to address you? And I told them, the correct term is His Emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. So if you call me, you say, Your Emptiness? That's a nice word. So great, yeah, so you're becoming like Her Emptiness, whoever wrote that. So you're letting go of, you're travelling on a path which has nothing to do about myself. Exactly. You're becoming Her Emptiness, whoever wrote that question. So carry on that way, you're going in the right direction. See what happens next. Why most of the people only believe in religion or really practicing their religion serious after they fall down in their life? Fall down in life can be chronic sickness, broken marriage, loss of loved ones, etc. Because you've been badly brainwashed. You've been brainwashed by the TV to feel that if you have the right soap powder on your clothes, you'll be attractive to the opposite sex. That if you become rich and famous, or you have the right hair shampoo on your hair, then you have lots and lots of boyfriends. You think that happiness lies in getting the new house or the new car. Because you see people on the adverts, they get a new car and they're so happy. I've got my new Volvo, I've got my new Proton. And so you believe all that junk and you spend all your money on junk. And are you happy? No. And there are some religions which still don't make you happy, but if you go to the right ones, the ones which don't just promise you things, but actually you can see that actually makes you happy, then this is no longer following false advertising. You'll actually see actually these religions actually work. You don't need to have tragedies. Like in my own life, I had no tragedy at all. I was doing really well in life. You know, I had girlfriends, I had a great degree from a good university, young, fit. You know, the world was my oyster, and I gave it up. I never became a monk because I was suffering. I became a monk because I was happy, but wanted to get more happy. That was my reason. So, you don't need tragedy to become religious. You just need to be wise and see that even if you're happy now, you can be more happy. Even if you have not many problems now, you can be even more free of problems. That's why religions like Buddhism is not just for people suffering, not just people in tragedies. It's for people, all types of people. And that's, I've known that certainly in Australia, in Malaysia, Singapore. You get very many successful people becoming Buddhists. Millionaires, billionaires becoming Buddhists. They're not having any tragedy. They're realizing that there's more to life than the big cars and everything else. And they're the ones who are really interesting. Dear Ajahn, what happens in my company now is all the top management, senior managers and directors always put the problem down without any responsibilities.
which resulted in the lower level of employees suffer due to inefficiency and ineffectiveness in daily work. Hence, a lower level of employees become can't put down the problem because if we want to do the best for the company. Please advise what we should do. Many companies are way behind the times in their business practices. This is old-fashioned business which doesn't meet the needs of the 21st century. If you want to hear cutting-edge company policy, come to Mahinda Rama Temple and listen to Ajahn Brahm. And I'm saying this for truth, because when you put the problem down without any responsibilities, you pass the buck, it means nothing ever gets done. The problem in a company is never someone else's problem. It's never my problem if you're the director. Whose problem is it? It's always our problem. In Buddhism, we know that life is a relationship issue. Your relationship with life, your relationship with yourself, your relationship with the person in front of you. In a marriage, it's relationships. And that's why I said the other day, every time I give marriage blessings, I always look at the groom and say, from now on, you should not think of yourself. I look at the bride, same thing, you should not think of yourself from now on. And the bride and groom nod and say, yes, we should not think of ourselves. Then I look at the bride and say, you should not think of him either. Then I look at the groom, don't think of her either. And this is a great way of teaching by confusion. Because we're waiting. What is the solution to this riddle? From now on, you should not think of yourself. From now on, you should not think of your partner. From now on, you should think of us. And there's a huge difference there. Thinking of your partner, thinking of yourself, is missing the point. You're married. It's about us now. In an office, the boss and the junior, the boss should never think of himself. The boss should never think of the junior. The junior should never think of themselves. The junior should never think of the boss. Junior and boss should think of us. The company, we're in it together. Problems become shared. And you find if two people put the effort into solving a problem, you've got twice as much chances finding a solution as if you just put it on one person. It's obvious. So I don't know why in a company you always give the problem to someone else to fix up. The boss gives it to the junior gives it to the temp. It always goes past the line until the most incompetent person ends up trying to solve the problem. That's the most stupid thing to do. So everybody, if it's a problem, we share it. And if it's our problem, we will find solutions. If you blame someone else, it's your problem. Solutions never get found. So that sort of company, they're missing out on progress. That's past century company policy. Resulted in a low level employees suffer due to inefficient ineffectiveness. Managers, you get those promotions because you should be wiser. It's not just you get the perks of management. The wisdom of management should make sure that you can work together with other people and share problems. My master Ajahn Chah, he knew that many of his monks would one day become abbots and leaders. And he told me, I remember this, and I keep this as an important teaching. He said, if you're going to become a leader, a Buddhist leader, even more important than your wisdom, even more important than your ability to meditate or your insights, is your compassion. He said, if you're going to be an effective leader, develop compassion more than anything else. And I took that on board. And if Chao Po calls me a compassionate monk, maybe that's the reason I got many disciples, why you can be a leader. Not the wisdom, not the skill in meditation, but compassion. is the most valued trait in any leader. If you can be a compassionate manager or CEO, then you'll have all your people wanting to work for you. And you'll have everybody on board. You'll motivate them, unite them, and you can find a huge number of solutions to any problems because you've got everybody working together. What Daniel Goleman called it in his great book, Emotional Intelligence. He was tracking, if you haven't read that book, it's a great book, even though it was 10 years ago, it's still very pertinent to modern business practices. He was tracking all of these high flyers in universities, people who got double firsts, great PhDs, because he wanted to know, will they become successful in life just because they got these great prizes in university? And to his surprise, no. All those people who got double firsts, great PhDs, they fizzled out. And they never did very much in life. You know, the Dell of Dell Computers, he dropped out. Bill Gates, drop out. Steve Jobs, drop out. I don't know about Warren Buffett, but he's probably drop out too. He said, how come that your degrees and what you learn in your university does not predict you'll be successful in life? So he started to think, what does predict success in life? And that's where he discovered it was not your academic intelligence, it was your emotional intelligence. These were the people who had friends at university, who made networks, who had contacts, who had social skills. These were the people who became the leading CEOs and inspirational leaders in our world. And he realized that in universities we were measuring the wrong qualities. Academic intelligence is no guarantee of success. Emotional intelligence is. And that's what Ajahn Chah was meaning. Develop compassion, kindness, sensitivity. That's a core part of emotional intelligence, and you'll be successful. So as managers, emotional intelligence, doesn't matter how many degrees you've got, the emotional intelligence, ability to network, connect with people, hear them, listen to them, convey information, being kind, trustworthy, that is what gives you success. Is it correct to say that if we don't have a good sila, we won't be able to progress much further in our meditation? Yeah. Because if you can't let go of the bad behavior which causes lots of trouble to yourself and others, how can you let go of the refined stuff? So if you can't let go of the coarse stuff, you'll never be able to let go of the refined stuff. And after a while, keeping like virtue, it's just common sense. People are really stupid when they break their precepts. It is stupidity as far as I'm concerned, because it's obvious you're much happier, have a much greater time. Look, this is for all the any young people here. I was at university when I gave up drinking alcohol. When I gave up drinking alcohol at university, I said I like going to parties, I like girls. When I gave up drinking alcohol, I thought, my goodness, this is a sacrifice. I'll never get invited to any party ever again. That's what I thought. But as soon as my friends heard I'd given up alcohol, I started getting more invitations to parties. And I didn't know why. You know, who wants somebody who doesn't drink and joining with everybody else? But they wanted me there. Because they wanted, after the end of the party, someone sober to drive them home. That was me. So I got big advantage from being sober. I got invited to more parties. And being practical. Boys and girls, what's the best time of a party? Usually the last couple of hours. You know, when you find your girlfriend, you've done all the dancing, you're sitting in the corner. You know what you're doing, kissing, cuddling, all that sort of stuff. Before, when I was drinking,
I couldn't remember that part. I missed out on the best part of a party. And now when I was sober, I enjoyed every minute of that. So it's obvious, it's common sense to me. So when you get drinking, you lose your mindfulness, you don't enjoy anything. You're just in some stupor, you don't know where you are. So you can't enjoy life. So even as a lay person, it made sense to me. Gee, keep your precepts, you have much more fun. And you do. Dear Ajahn, I would like to ask about forgiveness. Should one continue to be guilty even after asking forgiveness and one is not forgiven? No, you've asked for forgiveness. So if the other person won't forgive you, you forgive yourself. And if you can't forgive yourself, come up to me, I'll forgive you. What's the point of guilt? Does guilt help? All that guilt does is makes you miserable. And there's enough miserable people in this world already. We don't need any more. It's full of miserable people. We want happy people. So you're not helping anybody else by feeling guilty. You're not helping yourself by feeling guilty, because people who feel guilty usually do the same thing again for which they felt guilty. It's called recidivism. Forgiveness is how you let it go. You learn from what you did wrong, you forgive, and you have strategies so you never do that again. That's all you need to do. And that was straight down the line Buddhism. Something which struck me as a student, brought up in the West, exposed to Christianity, which was guilt-ridden. I was supposed to feel guilty for something Adam did and Eve did. Now, even if they did exist, thousands of years ago. Said, I never did anything. I never ate the apple. Why should I be guilty? And that made no sense to me. It was a guilt-ridden tradition. And people would say, if you don't go to church, you're going to go to hell. I felt guilty and afraid all the time. And it was so refreshing to come into Buddhism, where there was no guilt at all. People tried to kill the Buddha. There was this story of these assassins. Now, hired by King Ajatasattu, they had one man to go and kill the Buddha, two men to kill that one man, four men to kill the two men, eight men to kill the four men, 16 to kill the eight, and 32 to kill the 16. So by the time the 32 had killed the 16, no one knew who killed the Buddha. And that was the plan. And what happened? This guy came up to kill the Buddha. The Buddha didn't defend himself, just sitting there, smiling. Oh, you can't kill someone like this. He's just too cute and cuddly and nice. So in the end, what happened was the assassin just said, look, I can't do it. I've come here to try and kill you, but I can't do it. So what happened? What did the Buddha do? Call the police? You try to kill me, you evil man. You go to hell. No, he said, I forgive you. Never mind, just don't do it again. And then the Buddha gave him a Dhamma discourse. And at the end of that discourse, that man was a stream winner. Now that really hit me. Is that what you're supposed to do when someone tries to kill you? You don't even make them feel guilty, they had a bad thought. No, teach them the Dhamma and they become stream winner. Phew, that was great by the Buddha. So no guilt at all. Acknowledge, forgive and learn. And it's a great learning experience when you've done something wrong. So guilt has no part whatsoever. Doesn't help you, doesn't help anybody else. So instead, we just forgive and learn. Should we ask for forgiveness face to face of the person we have hurt badly? That's a dangerous one. If you've hurt them badly and you just face to face, they may put a fist in your face before you even say, may I forgive you? There's an old saying in Chinese, to love the tiger, but at a distance. So maybe when they're over there, say, hey, I forgive you, and then run away, just in case. Now, sometimes you've got to make the right time and place. Because if you've hurt someone badly, sort of find out the right time when they're ready for forgiveness. So you have to be very sensitive there.
And then you sort of give them that forgiveness. Or you ask for forgiveness from them, sorry. But before you do that, you have to ask forgiveness of yourself. You forgive yourself, first of all. And then ask them for forgiveness. Can we ask at the mind level, i.e. without the knowledge of the other person? Now, that doesn't really work. Eventually you have to tell the other person. But first of all, you forgive yourself. And then you ask forgiveness of that person at the right time and place. Have you got a question? Okay, considering the recent world financial collapse due to its opportunities for fraud and dishonesty and inefficiency, what real alternative system is there for the world economy? Is it really possible to go back in the system of barter trade, perhaps allowing only intrinsic value metal money? I don't think it's really possible to go back to metal money. We've come into the times of cyber money, you know, on internet. And anyway, actually, I don't know if you know this story. Remember Ajahn Chah, long ago, making a prediction. He said, later on in the world, we'll run out of metal for coins and paper for banknotes. So he predicted, in the future, human beings will use chicken shit for currency. So they'll go around with lots of pellets of chicken shit in their bags and their pockets. And they'll be so proud of how much chicken shit they've got. And especially if they've got more chicken shit than other people. And someone will go to your houses and steal your chicken shit. And he went on like this, because he's making the point, what is money anyway? It's just the value we give on it. And it's the same as chicken shit. If people value chicken shit, then that would be the currency of the world. But no, we'll always have this money. But obviously what you said in this question, it's the opportunities for fraud and dishonesty and inefficiencies. Those are the trouble. And all the regulation and laws in the world won't stop people finding ways around those laws to commit fraud and dishonesty. To commit fraud, rather. The only way is to encourage greater honesty. And that's the role of religions to do that. Doesn't matter what religion you are, to encourage honesty and to reward honesty as well. So we have to find ways in our system of rewarding good conduct and honest conduct. When dishonesty pays, then more people will be dishonest. So now one way, which is coming up in, say, many Western jurisdictions, is if they find people with too much money in their bank accounts, they have to prove, if they're asked to prove where that money comes from. And if they can't prove to the satisfaction of like a judge or a jury where that money came from, it's confiscated as illegally gotten money. So people who are drug trafficking, arms trafficking, fraud, loan sharking, if they found out they've got a huge amount of money in their bank account and they can't explain where it came from, it is confiscated. Which means that honest people, people who are doing business and keep records and they know this has come from hard work, they can keep that money. But people who are doing illegal transactions, dishonest transactions, corruption, they get caught out. It's called proceeds of crime legislation. Where if there's some suspicion there, you have to prove where that money came from. Otherwise it gets taken away. And what that's doing, that is taking away the reward for dishonesty. In other words, you're rewarding honesty that way. So the people who earn their money in a legitimate way don't have to compete with those who earn it in a dishonest way. Because all those people who are dishonest, they're taking away your money and our money. So that's one way of confiscating it. So the proceeds of crime do not sort of encourage fraud. Please comment on the following paradox from the Buddhist and scientific points of view. Change is the only constant. It's only a paradox because
That's an oxymoron. Change is inconstant. So what you're really saying there, inconstancy is the only constant. Change is the only thing which doesn't change. So the only reason that looks like a paradox is because it depends on which way you look at it from. It's just looking at one thing from two different angles. So that's why sometimes Ajahn Chah said, look, it's sometimes he says one thing and another day he says another thing. You're contradicting yourself. He said, no, I'm not. If I see a person riding a bicycle, they're leaning to the left, I tell them to go to the right. If I see a person riding a bicycle, they're leaning to the right, I tell them to lean to the left. So sometimes I say go right, sometimes I say go left. This is not a paradox, it's just looking at two separate incidents. And it's the same here, that change is the only constant. We're looking at change as a nature of things in life. But we look upon life in general, and this is constant, that change will always happen. So it's looking at things from two different perspectives. That's why it looks to be contradictory, but nevertheless, it is a valid statement. Given that Buddhists give so much significance to the power of the mind, what happens to a Buddhist person upon death with mental illness, mild schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, etc.? Would he, she be able to get a good rebirth, or would he, she be cast into the lower realm? It's a very good question. It's a very easy answer. If someone has like a mental illness, you know, it can be Alzheimer's, it can be autism, it can be any other psychosis, or even just, you know, mad, psychotic. When that person dies, when their mind separates from the brain, at that point they are free of that disease. Those are diseases of the body. We call it mental diseases, but it's actually a brain dysfunction. It's a physical dysfunction, which manifests as a impairment of your mental faculties. But it's really to do with the brain. So as soon as the mind separates from the brain at the time of death, then there's no mental impairment at all. You're back to normal. And at that time is when you can reflect upon Dhamma, your good karma, all those other things before you had that mental impairment, and that's where you can use those reflections to get a very good rebirth. A great example of that is, I think I told the story of the guy who came to 15 minutes before he died, didn't I? Did I tell that story a few days ago? People are nodding their head, yeah. There's many, many cases of people who have had diseases, mental impairment, and the last few seconds, or this particular case, the last 15 minutes of their life, they were totally free of their disease, speaking, acting in a total cogent, clear way. Because the last few minutes of your life, the stream of consciousness, what I've called the mind, separates from the body and is no longer affected by the brain. People who have shots of morphine before they die. The morphine clouds your mind. You go into a really muggy state. You have hardly any mindfulness at all. And because of that, many monks were telling me, said, look, if ever I get sick, don't shoot me with morphine. I'd rather have the pain and be mindful so I can get a good rebirth. And when I talk to doctors and nurses, and when I know how these things happen myself, you know, does not matter at all. You take that morphine to get rid of that pain, because the last few seconds before you pass away, that morphine-induced haze will clear as your mind is released from the brain, because this morphine just acts on the brain, acts on the synapses. The mental mind is totally separate. When that separates from the brain, doesn't make use of the brain anymore, then you are clear. Another example of that, which I saw, I collect all these interesting examples. This was a BBC documentary about an English man who lost his memory. No one knows why, or they didn't know at the start of this program. He was maybe in his 40s. He just began his second marriage. They found him unconscious when he came to. He couldn't remember anything from the past at all. He couldn't remember his wife, he just married, his home, anything. It wasn't Alzheimer's disease, because from that moment on, he could remember everything.
It was as if his memory had been wiped out previous to that moment, and he could accumulate memory from that time on. And it was such a weird case that people investigated it, but they tried to find out how this happened. You know, brain scans, they couldn't find any cause. So they tried hypnosis, which is fascinating because hypnosis gets to the mind without the brain. So it's another way of separating the mind from the brain. So they put him under hypnosis and he had perfect recall of everything that happened to him in his life. The reason why he'd lost his previous memory, he was in his garden in the tool shed, he was making something there, and he heard the telephone. This was before he had mobile telephones, the telephone in the house, dring, 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 dring. And he ran into the house to answer the telephone in time. The shutter of the shed was open. He'd hit his head on the shutter. And he must have hit it very hard in just the right place, and that knock wiped out his memory. And he remembered all of this under hypnosis, perfect recall, and it all made sense. And then they gave him the post-hypnotic suggestion: when you come out of hypnosis, you remember everything, including your past. And when he woke up, he still couldn't remember anything. But you could see what had happened. There was an injury to his brain, which meant in normal consciousness, he couldn't remember the past. But under hypnosis, or when he died, when his mind became separated from his brain, he would be able to remember everything. So if you have a mental illness, don't worry, it is impermanent, it does change. At death, you are free. Given the qualities, so some of the qualities, symptoms of a good Buddhist practice and schizoid personality disorder appear to be similar. E.g., in unable to something or sustain close permanent relationships. Now that's not good Buddhist practice, just hold close personal relationships, like being a schizoid person. In other words, you remain cool and calm under all circumstances, or you're not minimally reactive. This work, this something, social behavior, solitude. So how does one know whether one is practicing good Buddhism or is suffering from SPD? That's, what's SPD? I think it's schizoid personality disorder. Consult a psychologist or a Buddhist monk or both. So schizoid personality disorder, where you're unable to hold or sustain close permanent relationships, you remain cool and calm under all circumstances, you're non-reactive. Are you a schizoid or are you enlightened? Now the point is that as a Buddhist practice, it's different from the schizoid personality disorder, because you are able to build a sustained, not permanent relationship, but long-term relationships. As I have built long-term relationships with you. The point is you're willing to let them go. You can hold those relationships, but as soon as they're gone, they're gone. This is the difference here. This is a simile of my teacher. See this cup here? It's got a crack in it. Can you see the crack in the front? It's microscopic, so you can't see it. But it's there. One day I'll drop this cup, or someone else will, or they'll kick it, and that crack will open up. It will shatter, it will break. This cup is impermanent. Because it's fragile, because it's got a crack in it, the potential to break, that is why I must care for this. If this was unbreakable, made of some plastic, I could drop it, kick it, I would not need to care for it. Because it's going to break one day, that's why I care. And that's how Buddhists look at relationships. You've got a husband, a wife, a friend, a brother, sister, son or daughter. A Buddhist knows they're fragile. And it doesn't mean you don't form a relationship with that person. You form a relationship with that person in the knowledge that it's not going to last. And because it's not going to last, that's why you care so much. A schizoid personality disorder, they wouldn't even form a close relationship with it. They wouldn't be able to. The Buddhist does, knowing it's going to break. So when it does break, we had a wonderful time together, cup. Bye-bye, and I'll see another cup. So you can sustain close relationships, but not permanent, long-term relationships. And your emotions are not all abandoned. As a Buddhist, you let go of the negative emotions, greed, hatred and delusion, fear, guilt. Those are the things you let go of, which maybe a schizoid might let go of. But the positive emotions you cultivate, things like metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, the things like compassion and kindness and peace, which is an emotion, love, inspiration. These are things as Buddhists we develop. These are the positive emotions. Joy and laughter we develop. So these are the positive emotions. We let go of the negative ones. That also distinguishes sort of a schizoid personality disorder from a Buddhist. Yeah, they get rid of sub-emotions, but they have the positive ones. So they're not minimally reactive. If you tell me a joke, I laugh. If I get inspired, I cry. If I have a deep meditation, I'm just jumping up and down. And I deliberately cultivate that, because that's what happens. Seeing a monk like Ajahn Chah, he was one of the happiest people I've ever seen in my life. He would react, but only positively. Never ever negatively. So I think hopefully that answers those questions. What is the dominant influence on an individual's behavior? Is it nature or nurture according to modern psychology, or is it really karma? And if so, how does one overcome bad karma of a previous life to ensure a good happy life here and now, or this on this earth and hereafter after one's passing? Is it nature or nurture? And of course it's always a combination of both. The nature is like the karma of the past life. The nurture is the karma of this life. Remember, karma is always work in action. You come into this world with karma, but from the time you are born, you continue to make karma. In other words, the nature is the karma from the past, the nurture is what you do, the karma in this life. And if you have bad karma from a past, it means you have to do much more nurture, much more good karma in this life. If you have good karma from the past life, maybe you don't need so much nurture. But you can always nurture, nurture, nurture as much as possible. The classic simile, I'll do it very briefly, from opening the door of your heart, baking a cake. Two ladies baking a cake, one with good ingredients, one with bad ingredients. Who makes the best cake is not always the person with the worst ingredients, because the ingredients are only half of baking a cake. It's how much care and love and skill you put into that baking. So a person with very bad ingredients, they can put so much care and skill and love into their cooking that their cake turns out to be delicious, much more tasty than a person with the very best ingredients who are lazy and heedless. Because in the cake, it's what you make of the ingredients is important. In the same in life, you may be not so intelligent, beautiful or rich, or even clever as some other people, but that does not matter. It means you've got poor ingredients. What are you making out of those ingredients? What are you doing with them? So the way you nurture the meager ingredients of your life coming from your past karma, the way you make use of those, that is the most important of all. And in the time of the Buddha, there were prostitutes, there were
people with hunchbacks, street sweepers, people who came into the life with very bad karma. And even though they had bad karma from the past, they put so much care and nurture into their practice, they became fully enlightened arahats. So in Buddhism, yes, well, the karma from the past is important. That gives you the ingredients you have to work with. But it's how you make use of those ingredients. Look at me. I had some good karma and some bad karma. My bad karma was to be born in England. Cold, terrible food, and no Buddhism. That was a mistake. I should have been born in Penang. Nice and warm, good food, and lots of Buddhism. But nevertheless, I got here in the end. Despite meteoric advances in information communication technology, cell phones, internet, etc., mankind is still miscommunicating with each other, resulting in misunderstandings and unresolved conflicts. Well said. So what is the Buddhist way to improve communication between ourselves? Everyone knows how to send messages, but very few people know how to receive messages. So when you read your emails, do you read it fast or slow? When you look at your SMSs, are you really paying attention, or are you trying to get rid of it to go to the next one? When someone's talking to you, are you really listening, or thinking, when are they going to stop? I've got better things to do than to listen to her. So part of the problem is many people know how to talk, but few people know how to listen. And that's one of the problems with communication. Too many talkers, not enough listeners. Too many people sending information, not enough people reading the information. Communication has to have the listener. So if you really want to be a communicator, learn how to be a listener first. And when you hear the information, and you see the way that people just sometimes say too much or say it in the wrong way, then you learn from what other people do how to communicate yourself. I went to so many boring talks on Buddhism, but I listened and I realized that's not the way to give a talk. Because I listened, then I learned how to communicate. So you listen first, and then you communicate afterwards. What is the Buddhist view on formal punishment by the state governments, in particular capital punishment, which is so controversial? Basically, as a Buddhist, we usually don't agree with capital punishment. Number one, it's been proven centuries ago not to be a deterrent. Look, even in Malaysia, there's capital punishment for drug trafficking. Is that the case? Does that mean that no drugs come into this country? Still drugs come into the country. Where's the deterrent factor there? So a lot of times capital punishment is actually missing the point. You know, there must be other ways, put forth more strategies in solving these problems rather than deterrence. Fear of punishment only means that people are more clever not to get caught. When I was in school, every time I was punished for misbehaving, all I learned from that was to make sure I don't get caught next time. Speed cameras, do they have those in Malaysia? Does that stop people speeding? No, you all find out where they're located. So you can slow down before they catch you and then speed up afterwards. So it doesn't actually get people the problem. Why is speeding bad? Why is drugs bad? Why is stealing bad? So really the solution to such problems is, again, convincing people of why we need those rules to begin with. So once people are convinced why,
then we don't need the punishments anymore. And if people break those rules, instead of punishing them, it's like an education to teach those people, look, that's a very stupid thing you've done. My job is to make sure you learn so you never do that again. And once you learn never to do that again, off you go. Education, therapy. Just like if you get a disease, if you have a heart attack, are you punished for that? Do you have to spend time in jail for having a heart attack? Why not? It's your fault. You haven't been exercising, eating the wrong foods, stressing out. Your fault. And you're costing the Malaysian government a lot of money by having a heart attack, clogging up the hospital systems. You're a bad citizen of this country. You should have avoided it. But of course, we don't punish heart attacks. We treat them. Make sure the damage to the body is settled, healed, and also before you leave the hospital, you're told how to have a much healthier lifestyle. That's what happens. So this is what we should do, the same with what we call crime. Make sure that you learn, make sure you don't do that again, with strategies, so you live a much more virtuous lifestyle. And that's all we need to do. So once you've got your operation and your heart is healed and you're told to have a healthier lifestyle, out you go, live a nice life. The criminal justice system throughout the world has been shown not to work for a long, long time. You put people into jail, you still need bigger jails every year. That costs each one of you huge amounts of money. And the jails just become universities for criminals. You come out and you're even a more skillful criminal afterwards. And that's not just Malaysia, that's every country in the world. I think how many people are in jail in the United States? I think it's 2 million people. 2 million in prison. That's almost a whole country worth. And that's gross. What a waste of life. So there has to be another way. And there is another way. Dear Ajahn, if striving is the act of will, the controller, then why the Buddha gave advice to us was strive on diligently or else you will regret. Kindly clarify. He didn't say strive on diligently. He said apamadena sampadeta. Which is that word in Pali, people have had many translations of that. Apamadena means don't be heedless. And sambhadeta means just establish that lack of heedfulness. So many people, because they're worldly people, think, yes, you've got to put forth effort and strive. Because everything you've ever achieved in life, you've worked for, you've strived for, you've got it, well done. But in Dhamma, it works a different direction. Just before the Buddha became enlightened as a Bodhisattva, he put his bowl in the river Nirmala and made the resolution, if I am to become enlightened, may my bowl flow against the current. And it did. Not only did it say this was an omen about what was going to happen, it also told him how to become enlightened. To go against the stream of craving. To go in the opposite direction, where in this world we strive, we work hard to build monasteries, like I have done, to run Buddhist societies, to organize this retreat. Yes, you strive. To become enlightened, you go the opposite direction. That's what it meant, apamadena sampadeta. Be heedful, be fully mindful, and you will know from your experience, to be really mindful, you have to stop and let go. Renounce craving. And for many of you meditating here for the last 8 days, that's the most difficult thing to do. Because you're going against the stream. You're going in a direction you've never gone before. And it feels counterintuitive to go against the stream. But that's the way you get enlightened. That's also why very few people get enlightened.
They strive, and they get frustrated. It doesn't work. You let go, and it works. The key to success in business are happiness and peace. What are your views? If you're very happy when you go to work, the boss will wonder why, what you're doing. And if you sit there all day peacefully, you'll get the sack. No, you've got to work in business. Going against the stream works in meditation. When you're in business, yeah, strive, work hard. But do it efficiently. That was the message today. Learn how to strive efficiently. In other words, learn to have breaks every now and again. Do you remember when you were all at school? Did you do history, and as soon as history was finished, then English, as soon as English was finished, maths, and as soon as maths was finished, Chinese? No, you had breaks in between. You used to call it playtime or lunch. Why did they have playtime or lunch? Because every psychologist knows if you try and work a child hour after hour after hour, nothing more goes in. It's not the efficient way for teaching a child knowledge. You give so much, rest. A bit more, rest. A bit more, take a break. But in business, we forget that. For those of you old enough to remember the British Empire in Penang, one of the reasons the British Empire became so successful is because every morning they had tea break. Every afternoon, tea break. They knew how to de-stress. But people don't do that anymore. They have a cup of coffee, they're at the computer drinking, they don't actually what they're drinking. This is actually rice, not tea. So please give yourself a break. It's all about efficiency. So that way, actually, you are more productive, and actually happiness makes you more productive. So that's why sometimes I have happy days in the office, where you, you know, dress in a red nose or something. It makes happiness and people more productive. If we know our mind is controlling us, is deluded, what shall we follow? Or we shall follow the voice of our heart. Don't follow anything. Just be here, be still. If you follow someone, you go over there, and then you see another person, and you come over here. Sometimes you're just like these dogs who follow people. Sometimes I see these stray dogs, and when you're on arms round, they follow you. They say, go away, I'm a monk, I can't take you home. But your job is not to follow anything. You just stay where you are. Things can come and you don't follow them. Things can go and you don't follow them. You just stay here. So don't be blown around by the four worldly winds. Don't follow anything. Be like a rock, like a pillar. My father and grandma love me, but they tend to have lots of negative thoughts and bad speech towards people. I find that I'm afraid of getting close with them. My actions of ignoring them sometimes made them feel bad. What should I do to open up my heart for them and myself? How can I help them as well? Thank you. Did I tell the story of Kuan Yin and the mother-in-law? Yeah, that's a very good story there. Basically, in brief, that there was a woman in Perth whose mother-in-law was always giving her so much trouble. She couldn't get close to her. The mother-in-law was always treating her unkindly, saying bad words to her, just like in this. And so she tried many, many things, and what worked for her, she was meditating, she had a vision of Kuan Yin in her dreams. No, not in her dreams, in her meditation. She saw Kuan Yin there, you know, just the ordinary figure of Kuan Yin, but the only strange thing was Kuan Yin's face was the same as her mother-in-law's. But as soon as she identified her mother with the goddess of mercy, which she would worship and pray to, the next time she saw her mother, she said, oh, this is Kuan Yin. And because she regarded her mother in a totally different way, her mother then regarded her in a different way. And within a couple of weeks, their relationship was so good. So if you're a follower of Kuan Yin, regard your father and grandmother as Kuan Yin. And the next time you look at them, they may say bad things to you, but this is Kuan Yin. If that doesn't work, maybe the Buddha. Or if that doesn't work, maybe regard your father as Ajahn Brahm. Or whatever. And then the whole attitude changes. So basically, you have to change yourself, first of all. So you'll never change your grandma and father without changing yourself first. So develop strategies of developing huge loving kindness. Loving kindness towards yourself and loving kindness towards them. It takes a lot of work, but you can do it. And after a while, you do find they do change. Because what you get, you'll find is what you've given. So somehow you've actually treated them with negativity. You may not notice that, you may not realize that, which is why they're treating you with negativity back. So maybe you have to bear with negativity for a little while longer until your bad karma wears out. But in the meantime, give them lots of love and kindness and respect. And then their negativity will change. I'm not an advanced meditator, but I often meet people who will benefit from meditation but will not go to meditation classes due to various reasons. How do I introduce meditation to them? Or is there any way I can share with them the way meditation in a short 1 minute? Yeah, you can teach them. I hereby authorize everyone here to teach meditation. You are authorized, you're initiated. So why not? Because that shares it around. You don't need to be a monk to teach meditation. Just like, you know, in any school you have the headmaster and you have the senior teachers and you have the junior teachers and the teaching assistants. So there we are. And this retreat, you know, I am the headmaster, you are the deputy principal, and maybe the organizers here are the senior masters, and all of you are also the teachers, and the ones who are not on the retreat are the teaching assistants. So please share what you know about meditation. Even when I was a school teacher, I knew meditation, but only just in brief. But when it came, remember, like at your school you have school assemblies? As a new teacher, I had to teach the school assembly for 1 week, 5 days. And the headmaster said, do whatever you want. If you're a Buddhist, do something Buddhist. So I had 650 children, this is in a high school, from 11-year-olds to 18-year-olds. They're all sitting down like this. I went on the stage and said, right, we're going to do some meditation. Cross your legs, straighten your back, close your eyes, and count your breaths. And I had 650 kids going absolutely quiet. And for 5 minutes they all meditated. And when they finished, I said, you can come out of meditation. This is true. They burst into spontaneous applause. They all started clapping. And the headmaster and other teachers, they were so shocked. They said they'd never seen, ever, such quietness in the school. And then one of them said, what would you have done if one of those 650 children hadn't cooperated, if they started laughing? And you know that sweat came out, because I never thought that would happen. If I'd have thought that would have happened, I'm sure it would have happened. Because I had this stupid overconfidence, because I believed everyone would cooperate, they did. Later on, when I was a monk, I was visiting, there was a monastery not far from that school, and this guy came up to me and he said, you know, do you remember me? I said, of course I don't. And he said, I was one of those kids. He said, that changed my whole life. He was now actually the religious education teacher in that school. He said, you taught me meditation. And I was only a school teacher, I was not a monk yet. And I actually helped somebody. So, don't wait until you're fully enlightened or got jhanas, or you're a monk or a nun. Now you can teach, you can help, why not? Many of my students in Perth teach meditation. Okay, there's still some more to go. Backlog again for Malaysia. Never mind, we'll try it together tomorrow. One more night tomorrow, and so tomorrow I will really, really try hard to finish all the questions. But now it's 10 o'clock and it's time for everyone to go back home. Hope you enjoyed the talk tonight, and hopefully it will improve the economy of Malaysia, making Penang the powerhouse of the economic revival
of the state of West Malaysia. Okay, so here we go. Sharing of merits.
Idamen yatinang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idamen yatinang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idamen yatinang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu,
sadhu. Very good. So tomorrow night, same time, same place, the last talk of this session on Tales of a Forest Monk. I don't know what's going to happen, but anyway, I'm sure I can find some nice interesting stories. Some snake stories, some ghost stories, enlightenment stories, or interesting tales of a forest monk coming tomorrow in a temple near you.